Chapter 14. The scene was so awe-inspiring in its terrible beauty that Trout almost forgot the predicament he and Gamay were in. Paul sat on a rocky ledge about 20 feet above the lake, long legs dangling down, swiveling his head back and forth to take in the whole panoramic sweep. He had to strain his neck to see the tops of the falls. Multiple rainbows arced over the 5 cascades as the sun caught the droplets of water in the twisting vapor cloud that rose for hundreds of feet. The roar was like that of 100 distant locomotives at full steam. Trout wasn't a religious man, but if anything was the hand of God, he was looking at it. A groan ended his reverie.
"What are you doing?" Gamay said with a yawn.
She was lying nearby in the shade of a tree.
"Thinking what a great place this would be to build a hotel."
"Ugh," Gamay said with a scowl. She sat up and wiped the sweat from her face. "Make sure you have air conditioning." It had rained briefly an hour before, and the sun returned with a vengeance. Their perch was well shaded by trees and bushes, and they slept for a time. But there was no way to escape the suffocating humidity. Paul was the first to awake.
"I'll get you some water," Paul said.
He fashioned a palm leaf into a cup, climbed down to the lake, and scooped up water in the makeshift container. He spilled half the contents, bringing it to Gamay, who was trying to pick blades of grass from her ratty-looking hair. She guzzled the water, her eyes closed in bliss, then passed what was left to Paul.
"Thanks," she said with a smile. "That was refreshing. I hope you won't mind if I take a dip in our water supply."
She climbed down to the lake, plunged in, and swam out several strokes. Paul was thinking of joining Gamay after he had quenched his thirst, when a movement near the river outlet caught his eye. He called out a warning, but Gamay couldn't hear him because of the rumble of the falls. He climbed down, half falling, to the water's edge and dove in. He swam out to Gamay, who was peacefully floating on her back, and grabbed her by her T-shirt. Gamay was startled at first, then she laughed.
"Hey, this is no time to get playful."
"Hush," he said. "Get back to shore. Hurry." The urgency in his voice was unmistakable. Without a further word, Gamay swam quickly to shore with Paul right behind her. She started to climb onto the ledge. Paul pulled her down into a bush. He held his finger to his lips and pointed toward the lake. Gamay squinted through the leaves and tensed as the sun glinted off wet paddles, and she saw flashes of blue and white. Chulo. Paul had seen the 4 canoes emerge from the river into the lake. They would have run right into Gamay. The canoes were moving in single file. Each canoe held 3 Indians. 2 were paddling, and the other was riding shotgun, his bow resting across his lap. They seemed intent on where they were going and unaware that they were being watched. The Indians passed within a few yards of the hiding place, so close the beads of sweat on their rippling muscles were clearly visible. They moved silently across the lake until foggy tendrils enveloped them. An instant later, they disappeared into the vapor cloud.
"That was some vanishing act," Paul said, puffing his cheeks out.
"Now we know why they're called the People of the Mist," Gamay said. Using his 6'8" height to good advantage, Paul stood cautiously and made sure there were no stragglers.
"All clear," he said. "We'd better think of getting out of here. I still have the Swiss Army knife. Maybe we could fashion a raft with logs and vines and float our way out."
Gamay was staring toward the mists.
"I have a better idea."
She paused.
"It may be a little risky."
"A little risky?" Paul chuckled. "Don't forget I'm well acquainted with the way your mind works. You're about to suggest that we follow those guys and steal a canoe."
"Why not?
Look, this is their home turf, so they won't expect it."
"With all due respect for your talents with a Swiss Army knife,
I can't see us fashioning a boat that will carry the two of us God knows how many miles downriver without sinking, or running into more of those characters. It was tough enough traveling in an airboat. They can't paddle those canoes all day. They must pull them up somewhere on shore. We just find them, wait until dark, and slip one away. They'll never even miss it, I bet. Amusement crept into Paul's large hazel eyes. Do I detect a hint of scientific curiosity in your proposal? Okay, I admit there's more here than simply a matter of survival. Don't tell me you haven't wondered about this high-tech tribe and the talk of a white goddess. I was wondering if they have any food, Paul said, patting his stomach. He chewed thoughtfully on a blade of grass. Seriously, we're in something of a pickle and really don't have many choices. We don't know where we are and aren't sure how to get out of here. We have no supplies. As you pointed out, this is their territory. I suggest that we reconnoiter. We're strangers in a strange land. We go slow, and if the situation looks too dangerous, we get out in a hurry.
Agreed, Gamay said. Now, as for food, I'm fresh out of granola bars. I've been watching the birds eating the berries on that bush. I don't see any dead birds, so they're probably not poison.
Berries it is, Paul said. They can't be that bad.
Trout was wrong. The berries were so bitter it was impossible to eat even one without puckering up. With empty stomachs, the trouts struck off along the shore of the lake. At one point where the mud looked like quicksand, they climbed to higher ground and stumbled onto a footpath. The trail was overgrown and looked as if it hadn't seen any recent use. Still, they proceeded cautiously, ready to dive into the bushes if they encountered anyone. They trekked along the path for about a mile until they came to a place where mists from the lake rolled into the forest like vapor from a fog machine. The leafy growth was as wet as if it had been pelted by a rain shower, and the roar of the falls was like the beating of 1,000 kettle drums. They were aware that the same noise that muffled their movement could drown out the approach of a marching army. The air became chilly and so damp that they put their hands over their noses so they wouldn't gag. The visibility was only a few feet, and they kept their heads low so their eyes could pick out the path. Then, suddenly, they were out of the forest. If they were expecting to burst out onto a beautiful valley like wayfarers in Shangri-La, they were disappointed. The forest was no different on the other side of the mists. The path no longer led along the lake, but instead veered off along a tributary that the canoes must have followed. After a few minutes, Gamay stopped and shook her head. "Notice anything strange about this little river?" Paul walked over to the edge of the banking.
Yes, it's much too straight to be natural. It looks as if someone has taken an existing stream and marsh and cleared them out with shovel and pick.
My thoughts exactly.
Gamay started walking again.
As I said, the Chulo are most fascinating.
They plodded ahead for several hours. They had fashioned hats from palm leaves and stopped frequently to quench their thirst from the river. At one point they waited out a shower. They became more tense and watchful as the path widened, and they began to see the imprints of a bare foot in the soft, dark earth. After a short discussion, they decided to follow the river for a while longer, then hide in the forest until dark. They were dog-tired and needed to replenish their energy. As they plodded along, they encountered a path coming in from the forest to their right. It was made of thousands of flat stones and reminded Gamay of the Maya or Inca roads. It was as good as anything she had seen on the Appian Way. Their curiosity got the best of them, and they followed the paved path for 5 more minutes. They were drawn on even farther by a gleam through the trees. The walkway widened into a perfectly circular clearing about 50 feet in diameter, and also surfaced entirely with stones. In the center of the clearing was a large object.
"I'll be damned," they said in unison.
The jet plane was in two sections. The front was intact, but the passenger cabin was virtually gone. The tail section was in fair shape and had been moved directly behind the cockpit, giving the aircraft a short, stubby look. The paint was old and faded, and not overgrown by vines or lichen, as might be expected. They peered through the cracked cockpit windows, expecting to see skeletons. The seats were empty. Directly in front of the cockpit was a shallow pit holding the blackened ashes of fires and charred bones of small animals. Carved totems, as tall and thick as a man, ringed the stone circle. The figures adorning each post were different. Carved in dark wood at the top of each pole was a winged woman with her hands cupped in front of her. It was the same figure carved onto the medallion they had found on the dead Indian.
"It looks like some sort of shrine," Gamay whispered.
She went over to the ash pit.
"This must be where they burned sacrifices, mostly bones from small animals."
"That's certainly reassuring," Paul said. He looked up at the sun, then checked his watch.
"They've got the plane positioned so that it acts like a sundial. It reminds me of the layout at Stonehenge with the concentric rings that acted as a celestial calendar."
Gamay put her hand on the plane's nose.
"Does this blue and white color scheme seem familiar to you?"
"What do you know? The Chulo national colors."
Gamay's eyes widened as she looked past Paul, who had his back to the forest.
"That's not the only thing around here that's blue and white."
Paul turned and saw about 20 Chulo Indians emerge from the trees, their faces and bodies painted the colors of sky and bone. He cursed himself for allowing the plane's discovery to push caution aside. As silently as the ghosts they were reputed to be, the Indians surrounded them. There was no way to run. Paul and Gamay were completely boxed in. The Indians advanced with their spears held high. But then they did a peculiar thing. They opened the circle. One Indian indicated with his spear that they were to go through the opening. The Trouts glanced at each other for mutual reassurance. Then, with the silent Indians flanking them like a military honor guard, they marched from the shrine and followed the path along the river. The path widened into a road that took them to a stockade palisade. They made their way toward a gate wide enough to drive a truck through. From a distance, they had seen on either side of the gate tall wooden staffs that had knobs on the top like flagpoles. As they neared the entrance, Gamay squeezed her husband's hand even tighter.
"Paul, look," she said.
He followed her gaze.
"Oh, hell."
The knobs were, in fact, human heads. Their faces had been baked brown like apples in the sun, and the birds and insects had been making inroads. But it was still possible to pick out Dieter's features. He wasn't smiling. Neither was Arnaud or his taciturn assistant, Carlo. The fourth head belonged to their Indian henchman. Trout recognized him by the New York Yankees baseball cap. Then they were through the gates, past the grisly decorations. Behind the fence were several dozen long thatched huts clustered along the river. No women or children were visible. Their guards had lowered their spears and unstrung their arrows, and were using the presence of their bodies to keep the Trouts from trying anything foolish.
Paul said, "Look at that water wheel. We have them like that in New England."
Water had been diverted from the river and was flowing through wooden chutes to turn a wheel. They didn't get the chance for a closer look. Their guards directed them toward a structure at the center of the settlement. It was four times bigger than any of the surrounding huts, and the walls were made of putty-colored clay rather than saplings. They stopped in front of a portal that looked like a large gaping mouth. Hung over the entrance was the bladed fan from a jet engine. The Indians closed ranks behind them, put their weapons aside, and kneeled with their noses touching the earth.
"Now what?" Gammy said with astonishment at the sudden submissiveness of the fierce Indians.
"I wouldn't advise running for it. We wouldn't get 10 feet before they nailed us. My guess is they want us to go in. After you, madam."
"We'll go in together."
They walked hand in hand through the doorway into the dim interior. They passed through 2 smaller rooms, then into a large space. At the far end of the hut, visible in a shaft of light coming through a hole cut in the roof, was a seated figure. The figure raised its arm and beckoned for them to approach. They moved ahead slowly. The floor was made of wood, not dirt like the huts they had been in before. The figure sat on a throne made of what looked like an airplane seat. With the exception of 2 tanned and shapely legs, most of the body was hidden behind a blue and white oval mask that could have come out of a nightmare. It was painted with huge eyes and a wide mouth with sharp-pointed shark's teeth. The Trouts stood nervously in front of the bizarre figure, not knowing what to do. Then 2 hands came from behind the mask and lifted it off.
"Phew, this thing is hot,"
the beautiful woman behind the ugly mask said in English. She set the mask aside, cocked her head at Paul, then at Gamay.
"The doctor's Trout, I presume?"
Gamay was the first to speak through their astonishment.
"How do you know our names?" "We white goddesses see all and know all."
She laughed when she saw the puzzlement deepen even more.
"I'm a poor host, teasing my guests."
She smiled and clapped her hands lightly. The Trouts were in for another surprise. The beaded curtains behind the throne parted with a rustle, and Dieter's wife, Tessa, stepped out.